But Indian students from Hampton also served as another kind of object lesson. In May of 1882, General Armstrong and two of his Native students visited members of Congress in Washington, D.C. to petition the government to honor treaties made with tribes, to fund schools, to grant individual Indians land, and to recognize Indian legal rights under U.S. law. Prior to Elk v. Wilkins, 1884, when the Supreme Court ruled that John Elk could not vote in Nebraska because he was an Indian and therefore not a citizen, the potential of Native Americans to become citizens was very much a question. As part of Armstrong's presentation, a Pawnee and a Shawnee student from Hampton came with him. And they were dressed in the cadet uniforms of Hampton, like the boy standing there next to Lewis Firetail. They were described explicitly as the object lesson of the evening, standing there before Congress. And the young men told their own stories. Then they left the stage and returned in, full Indian toggery, speaking to each other in sign language. But their graceful gestures and picturesque appearance was not quite right. As a commentator noted at the time, their clothing was too clean, their manners too refined. The observer continued, their first impression was the strongest, and the audience instinctively knew that Hampton had eradicated the savage. Somehow, by dressing as Indians, they convinced the audience of their civility. Perhaps Firetail here, posing for Johnson's camera, as well as for his teacher and classmates, served as such a lesson. On first glance, his costume appears to be roughly appropriate to his broadest tribal affiliation, but I sat down with Emil Hermeni Horses of NMAI, the National Museum of the American Indian, to try to figure out what was going on here. And looking closely, I mean, we have four different tribal groups represented in what he's wearing, right? It shouldn't be belted, he has this woodland bag, everything is completely off in this, in what he's wearing. And in fact, in going through Johnson's papers a little more carefully at the Library of Congress, I found this other image of another student, another kid, not Lewis Firetail, wearing the exact same costume. So she may well have brought it with her that day to Hampton. Firetail had been at Hampton since the summer of 1897, roughly 2 years prior to this photograph, and he'd spent the previous summer in Massachusetts. There's no way he could have kept that long hair. I mean, he's definitely wearing a wig. In the costume he's wearing, he's probably, you know, never seen it before. And like the students Armstrong brought to campus, by playing Indian, in some ways, perhaps here he is offering a very powerful lesson on the true impact of his Hampton education. One that only a most skilled student could discern or understand. There's another image of Lewis that I found in the Hampton archives. And this was taken 3 years later by an anonymous photographer. And here he is on Crow Creek Reservation, back in South Dakota. Lewis's face is hidden by his hat, but his dress could not be more different than the Johnson image. His thick striped tie, his wide-brimmed hat, his watch fob suggest that he's an assimilated and rather fashionable young man. And this photograph was probably taken to document his marriage to Minnie Finley, a Caddo Indian from Oklahoma who had recently graduated from the Carlisle Indian School and was working as a seamstress. And remarkably, I was only able to find evidence of their wedding because they had a double wedding that was reported in the New York Times, actually, where it turns out, they didn't have a vow-style spread, but it turns out that the double wedding, the other couple, was a white man from New York who was marrying a Native woman. And so that was why it was worthy of reporting, Lewis and Minnie's wedding. In the Hampton student files, Firetail is described simply, farming, nice wife, children. In correspondence with Hampton, Firetail described his work as a carpenter in South Dakota and his plan to build a house using the skills he had honed at school. And he seemed to be embodying the domestic ideal Hampton had for its Native graduates. He was legally married in his own home, she's a seamstress, he's a farmer. A few years earlier, a missionary described the role of educated young Native Americans at Crow Creek. She described couples like the Firetails. I could show you home after home occupied by Hampton students, built by themselves and beautifully kept. The young men and women in them are object lessons to their own people and show to others what can be made of Indians. These two competing images of Lewis Firetail could act as two different kinds of object lessons. We have some version of Crow Creek at Hampton, some interpretation of Hampton at Crow Creek. Here, Firetail, it seems, is able to manipulate his image and use material and visual rhetoric he both learned and embodied at Hampton to create some kind of lesson that he was sending back to the school. I don't know if or how Lewis and Minnie Firetail benefited from the self-presentation or the pedagogical possibilities of their domestic life on Crow Creek. Even with access to the object lesson idea, it's hard to know exactly what the Firetail family may be trying to teach us with this photograph. Now, as a 21st century material culture scholar, I'm not very comfortable applying material culture methods to the study of people. That's something we don't usually do. And those of you who may be trained in decorative arts, as I am, might be more comfortable applying the object lesson idea to something like this, to a chair. We all know deck arts people love chairs, right? So we're going to conclude by thinking about this image. This is an image from the Carlisle Indian School. You know, Johnson went there after her successful photographs at Hampton and took photographs there as well. And I want us to look together at this to think through the object lesson idea and what it might mean for us as teachers of material culture, those of us who bring objects into our classrooms. I know I frequently bring objects into my classrooms or bring my students to places where they can access them. And we look at them and try different methodologies together. Let's think about what we might do with this image. This is a 1901 cyanotype, obviously, taken from a photograph by Johnson. And what we're looking at is an object lesson, or sometimes called a conversation lesson, on a chair. We have six Native American male youths standing around the chair with their teacher, staring intently, seemingly through the chair, at one of the boys. And I'd like us to imagine for a moment how we might teach with this chair. Could we imagine leading our students, or could I imagine leading my students, to offer a Prowling analysis of the chair on that table, starting with a description, spiraling outwards towards deduction and speculation, maybe bringing in some research? We might consider its airy form, the way it required one to sit, whether the curves on that seat suggest something about who might have used it. In both a Prowling analysis and in an object lesson, students could be led to find evidence of labor, of the material, of trade practices, of style, of function, of meaning, all of these things nucleating around that object, all of these things being associated and tied in to this material thing. As a classroom object lesson in 1901, the students may have initially discussed geometry, which is often what you're instructed to do first when giving an object lesson on a chair. Right? Perhaps developing concepts and associated vocabulary of things like perpendicular and parallel to describe the spindles and the seat of the chair. In the specific context of the Carlisle Indian School, the chair could also be about craft practice, and the students' potential to work as Native-made objects were explicitly considered object lessons in the promise of Native citizenship, both through labor and the consumption to be able to buy something like this through your labor. A chair could also quite consciously represent civility, the interior of a well-appointed single-family home, a dinner table people might sit around and eat at together. Like the home Lewis and Minnie Firetail proudly reported they had created for themselves using their Hampton and Carlisle education. Now, these notions, these interpretations of these chair are not my 21st century fictions. These are meanings that we can potentially unlock by using an object lesson method to try to figure out what this chair might have meant to the late 19th century people looking at it, studying it, trying to understand it in this classroom. The story of object lessons at Hampton and later Carlisle and at many other schools throughout the United States in the 19th century is just one of many examples of how this pedagogy shaped the ways 19th century Americans reasoned from and through their engagement with the material world. My hope is that scholars may be able to apply this object lesson idea, this form of visual and material rhetoric, as a tool to understand other aspects of 19th century American culture. And this is an application I've been experimenting with in other aspects of my own work. Object lessons pattern the ways Americans were supposed to find ideas and things. This is a particularly powerful notion in the context of 19th century material culture, the 19th century interior, which is so often viewed by scholars as full of signs, as saturated with meaning. This novel claim about object lessons transforms the material world into a series of legible ideas. Ideas that I hope might be easier for us to access with the analytical tool of the classroom object lesson. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. I think we're going to remove this
get the
podium,
exactly.
And then we can have... First questions?
Yes. Oh, and actually, you know what? I'm going to do, because we have a very great, diverse group tonight. When people ask, just introduce who you are and what of the many different departments you might be affiliated with, because I think that'll be useful for everybody to know.
Should we turn the lights up just a little bit? I know the object people want lights low. I like to see the people as well as the images.
Yeah, that's
awesome. Okay. I just want to first of all say hello. I'm Sonia Whitehope. I'm a doctoral candidate in school music and have a little history with Dr. Carter. Is that the right name? But I wanted to ask you, thank you so much. It's really fascinating thoughts and a lot to think about, a whole lot to think about. And as you know, being a musician and music educator, I'm always interested in the topic of sound and the etherealness of things that are framed by time and place. Yeah. And I'm just kind of wondering if you've encountered any role or context for, say, sound or smell, these things that are certainly objects, but they're very ethereal and they're very much framed by time and place in the your work on things.
Yeah.
Especially at Hampton.
That's a great question. At Hampton, there's nothing that I can think of specifically that relates to sound or smell. Oftentimes, object lessons on foods would include taste. And actually, no, that's not true. In the kitchen garden, taste and smell were very much a part of it. Because the idea was, how would you ever learn how to properly salt the soup unless you were tasting it? How would you learn how to deal with these sorts of situations? So there are poems and songs that describe things like salting. Salt in particular comes up. Which sounds very strange, and you read them, and
hear the salt song.
But some of them, I mean, they're very, it's very sort of surprising. I mean, I find myself being just so sad reading some of them because they'll say things like, don't let anyone know how you look or feel. You know, these are songs that are teaching kids from an early age how to dissemble, right? How to show that you were not actually upset or surprised by how you're treated. And so they're funny moments, they're absolutely funny moments, but then there are also moments in these sources where you feel just, like you can't believe a six-year-old is learning how not to show their true feelings. Like it's,
although that's a safety factor for that.
Absolutely, absolutely right. In terms of sound, I can think of object lessons on things like different kinds of metals, object lessons that involve porcelain. Identifying that sound is part of is part of the qualities of that object.
Right.
Yeah. So it does come up.
Okay, and Hampton has a very famous singing tradition, and I was just wondering if there was any relationship between that and the object.
That's a great question.
If you've encountered that, I mean, it's kind of out of your current research.
I haven't, but I mean, that's something I should look for. That's a great suggestion. I hadn't thought about that. But thank you.
Wonderful talk.
And you mentioned that, you know, these are being done all over the country, but yes. I'm kind of curious, because, you know, what you presented tonight is, you know, two very distinct schools. And I'm very interested in how ubiquitous it was in the country at the time. And have you noticed, are there differences depending on what type of school it is, mm-hmm. inner city, you know, an urban school or school in the more rural area,
yeah.
one with diverse populations, one without diverse populations? And if there's any differences, or is this sort of curriculum very, like, you know, structured and applied
well, in a different place? I think object teachers would love to think that this is being applied in the same way in schools across the country. But schools across the country are so varied at this point that it's really difficult to say. It's hard enough, I mean, I always think about this as I'm working on this, it's hard enough to assess what actually happens in our own classrooms in the 21st century, let alone what's supposed to happen. Right, that's something we all struggle with assessment in different ways as teachers. But object lessons are supposed to be being implemented in a fairly uniform way. And the school boards that I've looked at most closely are in New York, in both New York City and outside of New York City, in San Francisco, in Chicago, in Virginia. I mean, I found some pretty standard ways that these methods are being used in these places. But then again, it's so hard to know what's actually happening in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so what I've done is I've tried to find as many photographs as I can. I've gone through records of teachers' colleges. I've finding manuscript evidence of photographs, manuscript evidence, periodical evidence describing what's actually happening. Because while object lessons had a lot of proponents, there were also people who believed that object teaching was just another form of rote learning. That we could pretend that studying objects would open children's minds and teach them how to think. But in fact, if it wasn't done correctly, it would just be another way of memorizing and associating information with a thing, right? It wasn't going to be this possibility of expansive thinking. So, I mean, Charles Dickens, you know, wrote this rather funny story about it in the 1860s, where he describes, you know, I'm going to give you an object lesson on that thing burning a hole in that boy's pocket. And so a little kid raised her hand and said, oh, it must be coal, right? And of course the punchline is, no, it's a penny, right? Burning the hole in his pocket. There were teachers who would do things like that and call them object lessons. But of course they weren't. I've been able to go down to some level, like for example, in a place like New York, you can have a distinction between the colored schools in New York and as they were called, and schools that were geared more towards white children. And they're all using object lessons. The main difference is that they're being used for African-American children up until an older age, which may have to do with literacy levels obtained, because object lessons often go along with learning to read, as opposed to something that happens after you already know how to read. But that's something that I may never know, that I may not be able to find that evidence.
I had two questions. The first question is, I'm very interested in Boyd's cards, mm-hmm. because that's a case where there's kind of a commercial application
yes.
of a teaching tool. Mm-hmm. And can you follow that? Who's Mr. Boyd? Where are they marketed? Where are they sold? Where are they used? Is there some way of getting some answers to that
yes.
question through them?
I've tried to do that. So Oliver and Boyd is actually a company in Edinburgh. But there are four sets that survive in the United States right now. There's one at the Huntington, there are two at Princeton in the Coast and Children's Library, and there's one at American History in the Smithsonian. There may be others, but through lots of searching, there's only four I can find.
How many cards are there?
There are three different sets of cards. There is an animal kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, and I guess it a mineral kingdom. Right? Let me go with this. Tripartite, you know, like Aristotelian, we can have the whole world in these wooden boxes, right? These three kingdoms. And there are a dozen of them in the vegetable kingdom, and there are 20 in animal and mineral. And they're completely fascinating objects, because in some of them, I don't know if I have an example here, let's see. I think I might have brought a couple of other ones to show you. Because some of them actually, like this one, oh goodness, sorry, I advanced too far. You can see this is an example of how you never know what's happening. Here's a classroom photo I found in Princeton. There is the object lesson cards taped to the board. No one can touch those, right? You can't actually engage with them in the way you're supposed to, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, there they are. So some of them are completely fascinating, like this one on printing and type metal. The card itself, just like that lithograph about lithography, becomes a specimen that you can study. Right? So you have, you know, the type specimens, you have these different printing processes, so you can actually look at this and study this object to try to figure out what you can about how printing works.
Would they originally have been flip books like those two holes would suggest?
No, that was just to hang them on the wall.
I see.
Yeah. And what I found in one of the sets, that the text at the bottom, these are about this big, as you can kind of get a sense of from this photograph, I found in some cases the text being cut away. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps the text kept for the teacher's private consumption, whereas the objects could be circulated mm-hmm. on those cards. But I've tried to find out as much as I can about first Oliver Boyd and then later Bancroft Brothers. It was a San Francisco company that completely knocked it off and made their own version almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. But I found very little, unfortunately. I may have to go to Edinburgh and track them down.
Shame.
I can find someone to send me there. Yes?
Can you go on? Oh, okay.
Which department are you in, by the way?
Oh, sorry, I'm a graduate student in the English department.
Okay, great.
I'm afraid my comment and my question might be kind of naive, but I'm going to ask them anyway. The image you had up earlier with the last image you had with the chair and all the students looking at the chair and studying the chair, it struck me that if I were to observe a classroom today, and that was what was going on in the classroom, particularly the ages of those kids, they looked like they were maybe like high school age and younger sitting down. So if I were to observe a classroom and that's what's going on today, I would probably leave the classroom thinking that it was a rather innovative and kind of progressive teaching technique, and that mm-hmm. that teacher was kind of really unique and creative and had a really kind of forward-thinking approach to teaching and to learning. But I mean, this photograph is over 100 years old, and these kind of techniques, like you mentioned at the beginning, go back to, I think it was 1798 or something. So these are not at all like new or progressive techniques. So I guess my question is, why is it that I might still think of something like this as being progressive?
Great question.
So I guess another way of asking that same question was there a kind of fall off of these kind of lesson techniques sometime mm-hmm. in the 20th century? Or?
I think it's actually a really interesting question for the field of material culture in general, and also for the history of education. I think one of the challenges with the history of education as a field, and I don't know if we have any history of education people here, I'd be delighted if we did, but one of the challenges is, and I'm not trained as a historian of education, I came to this through material culture, through American studies, is that there's not much of an awareness of the history of pedagogy within the history of education. I've been surprised constantly that things keep being reinvented. It seems like again and again and again in the history of education, and that's something that I wish wasn't the case. I mean, as someone who's been trained in material culture for a long time, it was shocking to me to find this practice that I had never heard of, and that almost no one in material culture has ever heard of. And it was an extremely common way to get information from objects, or viewed as a way to link information to objects and to help someone present that. And as I mentioned earlier, it's very similar to the Prownian method, which is still a very popular way to interpret objects, even today in 2012. There are several reasons why this falls out of favor. One, it's the victim of its own success, in the sense that object-based learning becomes a part of the curriculum in lots of different ways. Nature study becomes extremely popular, and in many ways that comes out of this object lesson idea. Kindergarten, as I mentioned only briefly, is in fact, if we were to put together a family tree of kindergarten object lessons, it's a direct descendant. You know, kindergarten, we think of Frederick Froebel, who was actually a student of Pestalozzi. Montessori, again, we can add her to that family tree. These ideas are all pretty closely related. So we have this kind of method in our schoolrooms today. We just don't call it object lessons. In part, we don't call it object lessons because John Dewey hated object lessons. And in the history of education, there's no one who casts a greater shadow than John Dewey. In part, I think there's a bit of an anxiety of influence going on there, and that some object lessons ideas are a little bit similar to his work. And he really wanted to distinguish what he was doing from this earlier practice. And so he just, you know, critiques it so much that no one really wants to talk about doing object lessons, even if they're still doing some of the same techniques. And so it exists in lots of different ways, but not in the same way that it existed, obviously, in the 19th century. These things continue to change. But it does seem very innovative. Although, I mean, in material culture classes, I'm sure many of them here, I mean, you walk in, this was, you know, my class a few weeks ago, like you're studying chairs, you're examining these things. I mean, it's something that you do, but that's in a subject-specific area as opposed to a general class.
Did you have a hand up here before we let Marilyn?
I'm Rady Tisdale. I teach material culture at Tufts in the Museum Studies group.
Oh, great.
So my question is sort of related to that, which is, I definitely get the relationship with Brownian and Johnson. It makes perfect sense. But it's also making me think of visual thinking strategies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes.
Have you thought anything about the link between those or investigated it or...
I've thought about it, and that's something that I'm not sure how much I want to link this to museum education and to strategies that are often used in the museum education context. Mm-hmm. Because that doesn't really change over the course of the 20th century. I've been doing a fair bit of work just on the side at the Boston Children's Museum, which is founded in 1913. Their centennial is coming up. And that's, a decade or so after these images, and they're teaching with objects all the way through. That's one place where you can trace it. It does not change, right? The Children's Museum is founded by a group of science teachers who say, we want objects to use in our classrooms, right? All the way through that, that's a through line in museums. The place where it's not so much a through line is in the classroom, even though it's there in other ways. So that's something I've thought about, and I've looked into it, but I haven't pursued that. Mm-hmm. Just seems like that kind of expands it in a way. I mean, I would be delighted to think about that some more. I think it's, a very fair question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're definitely related.
Sorry, Marilyn.
So, when I'm conjuring these kinds of problems, I always like to think of what isn't there, what's omitted. And I'm wondering is whether in object lessons, whether it's an early 20th century object lesson on cotton, where the laborers are, and the labor that goes into it is omitted, or your 21st century classroom shop that you just, image that you just projected. is the Brownian method, is that how we say it? Is that consistent with object lessons or material culture study of objects that you don't address the sweat that goes into? I mean, I thought it was particularly ironic. Was the cotton exercise at Hampton?
Yes.
When you think of who those students are and the history of cotton and textiles, is it just completely absent? Is there just utter silence on that relationship?
From the sources or silence, I don't know what that teacher's saying in that classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wish I did. I don't know if those are lessons in particular that caused parents to, if that's what caused those parents to write in and say, why aren't my kids reading?
Mm.
Right? I don't know if that's, I think that would probably tick me off if I were in that situation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what caused them to send that letter or not. But I don't have any written sources or other sources other than these photographs to tell me what exactly happened at that moment. Here's another classroom scene. This one is a schoolroom near Tuskegee. I brought a bunch of additional images. This one is a schoolroom in Tuskegee. Corn and cotton. That's a big, big pile of cotton. And so, again, I don't know if the teacher is helping them see that the clothes they're wearing are a commodity that's created out of that cotton.
trying to imagine what would I do in this classroom now that I've read through all these books that these teachers have learned from. You know, maybe she's doing that. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm.
But it's so close to their parents who've been picking cotton. I know. And they probably are still picking cotton.
I know.
No, it's
hard
I know.
Not to see.
Yeah. I know. That's why I show them. But I'm trying to, just trying to understand what could be going on in that classroom. I don't know. But it.
I mean, is it uplift or is it racial squashing down?
Right.
That's going on in the classroom.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think it's both. I think it's both.
The whole stratification. Of even the example you gave of, you know, white students are doing object lessons, you know, the African American students are studying it, you know, into adolescence, and you know, it's all about racialized ideas about, you know, the concrete versus the abstract, and you know, depending on your racial background, how much you can, or the physical versus the cerebral.
Right.
That these ideas, the pseudoscience of racial classification as...
Professor Halter, in terms of, because you made a link about is this like the Prounian method, there are other steps in the Prounian method would actually involve after initial sort of interaction with the object and, you know, first sort of reactions to it and describing, there is sort of like kind of a research part of it, a sort of connoisseurship, so that you would get away from the object, you would like get more into sort of that style, or so you wouldn't be disassociated from like
so
that, who made it, yeah, because you're hoping to sort of get to the mentalities of who might have created the object.
But the only way you would get to that research stage is you have to go through speculation and deduction. So looking at that object is supposed to tell you where to research, right? If you look closely and you see evidence of tool marks, that could then lead you to research labor and tools. If you look closely and you speculate on how this might have looked in an interior, that might lead to a totally different research process. So it depends on what the person is bringing. I mean, both the Prounian method and object lessons really relies a great deal on what the person is bringing to that encounter. And there are other people who have written really interesting, I mean, in the period, in the 1890s, about ideas about object lessons and apperception. And apperception, this notion that, you know, object lessons only work if you're bringing together all of these different past experiences you've had and they can somehow be synthesized into this object. Anyway, sorry. I can keep talking. But I want to hear your questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for this talk. I actually have been waiting to talk to you about this for a long time because I read your dissertation, but it was brilliant.
So with that foregrounded, you touched very briefly on
Fort Marion, which is a kind of area of interest for me. And you have an image by Jane Gay, and that's a whole other topic. But I'm interested in, since Marilyn's raised this issue of sort of just the development of the pedagogy and where different sources were coming from. I was thinking about the role of Richard Henry Pratt and because Fort Marion was just this testing ground, but okay, two very important differences, I think. I mean, of course, it later bled into what happened at Hampton. But,
and Carlisle.
You know, But, you know, Fort Marion, in addition to being an imprisonment experience, was also, you know, a place that educated people of all ages, indeed some people who were in their 50s.
Yes.
And then also, it was primarily a military, approach to education. They were given uniforms, they were taught trades, there were elements of the sort of Booker T. Washington approach to education later on, in my understanding. At the same time, it also had that performative, you know, the people from St. Augustine were invited to come and watch the Indians give powwows. It was covered in Harper's. I'm just interested, have you been able to kind of tease out, you know, I understand you've delineated very beautifully the sort of progressive model and where it came from, but I'm interested in the sort of homegrown American frontier military approach to the object and the objectification of people.
So you're asking to sort of help me think about how we can isolate different strands of this desire to transform people into objects on display.
And exactly, and whether the Pratt angle has yet been examined. Because I think he's really, he's a big fan of this kind of
absolutely
education.
And there's an object that actually I don't think I should show, but I can show you later, that is an example of this at Fort Marion. You may be familiar with the life casts that were made there, which, you know, I'm always very ambivalent about showing in public because they're created under duress of the prisoners there at Fort Marion, and they're these very, very upsetting things to look at because they look like death masks. And there is a set of them at Harvard in the Peabody Museum. And so there are lots of ways that people are transformed into objects that intersect with my study. I mean, they're physically transformed into objects by me having life masks made of them. I mean, created by actually a sculptor. Then there is that sense of display that is different from this object lesson idea. Mm. But what strikes me so strongly is that even at Fort Marion, I mean, they're using object lessons. I only know this because, you know, Stowe actually is there, and she describes seeing object lessons in the classroom. Mm. She describes seeing the same kind of classroom pedagogy going on. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure how separate what's happening there is from what's happening at Hampton, mm-hmm. or what later happens at Tuskegee and Carlisle. I think it's part of a very similar desire to try to show, look how we can materially transform these individuals. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that the object lesson idea is used again and again and again. But I would be fascinated to know, I mean, to talk to you more about it, yeah. to, you know, see what else there might be. Yeah. Yeah.
Can we go back to the Johnson picture of Lewis Firetown?
Absolutely.
Indian costume, because that is such a troubling and interesting use of an object lesson. And
yes.
I had a question about whether the idea that he's a fellow student of the others, you know, some in westernized dress, and he's...
Yeah.
in the wig and the costume, and it's a pastiche costume,
yeah.
so that he's both an object, and then the whole notion that his body is an object lesson and the costume is an object lesson. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the possible intersection between costumes for object lessons and
yeah.
the people inside them, because you almost
yeah.
get the sense that from your description, well, maybe that whole outfit's going to be put on the woman with the bow, and then it's going to be put on the
right.
person further back, and then it takes
right.
on this kind of an interesting two-part thing going on there, in addition to the two-part thing of the Western dress versus the,
right.
you know, Native dress.
Throw in
and
there,
do you
too,
know if he ends up being... Oh, sorry.
I was just going to throw in there, too, that the other picture she showed of the transformation of a Native American young man, he's standing in the same posture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it could be. Well, actually, no. I don't think it can be Lewis because it's earlier.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if he speaks at all? Is he part of? Is he
like a statue?
Or object? Is he explaining?
Didn't you say they sign?
His own objectification.
Not in this case,
so
but they do other times.
And being
yeah.
a gazer at the same time.
We don't know. I wish. I mean, in doing archival research at. The National Anthropological Archive. I mean, that's the only. This photograph is around. Right? Mm-hmm. Most of us have seen it in some way.
Well, Laura Wexler has a nationalizing
yeah.
argument she makes with it.
Yes, yes, yeah. she does. But it hasn't been looked at in the context of Johnson's other images, and it hasn't really. I mean, the problem. I mean, just briefly, for those of you who maybe aren't familiar with this series of photographs, there are. I'm trying to think of how many, but well over 100 photographs taken of Hampton by Johnson at this point. Only a small subset of those become published actually by MoMA in the mid-20th century as this thing called the Hampton Album. And it's that Hampton Album that contemporary artists like Carrie Mae Weems and others kind of play with. And it's that album that most people are familiar with and that most work on this has been through that lens. But there are loads of other pictures at the Library of Congress that relate to these. So what I've tried to do is go back and figure out, both through what's at the Library of Congress and through the National Anthropological Archives, what else we can make out of this. There are just not as many sources as I would like. I have not been out to Crow Creek that's something I would love to do, to see if I can find any local sources mm-hmm. about the Firetail family. They later become the Fire family. I would love to know more about them. But the trail has run cold a bit. I don't know if he speaks, and I find it very difficult to try to figure out here how to unpack the distinction not only between Louis Firetail and what he's wearing,
and
but
the
there's the eagle right behind him. I mean, he's wearing an eagle bonnet, even though I learned from Emily Her Many Horses at NMAI that the bonnet's totally wrong, and it's probably, I mean, it's made out of the wrong kind of feathers. Like, there's nothing right about what he's wearing. But it is an eagle feather bonnet. I mean, there is something going on here between this person dressed in this outfit and this taxidermy eagle. But I don't know how he was selected. I know that around this time, there are tableaus at Hampton to celebrate various holidays. People are dressing in this kind of clothing. But again, this clothing likely came with Johnson. Because it's in her other studio shots. So it's a bit of a mystery. But it's been very helpful for me to try to think through some of the ways that students are put on display at Hampton. Mm-hmm. So that's how I've tried to use this as a way to kind of hold some of those ideas. Mm-hmm. And one challenge that I have in doing this whole project is almost everything turns into an object lesson in some way. I find myself replicating the same methodology. You know, you kind of get in this object lesson mindset, which I try to pull myself out of, but this becomes a lovely object lesson for thinking about Hampton with those layers and that complexity mm-hmm. and that messiness, I think.
Will, did you have a final question? Or
I was going to just make two comments about the images. One, it seemed to me that there might be also a resonance in what you were saying about learning to be like what it feels like to be certain, right? And that what does it feel like to be in these in this outfit rather than in the military outfit?
So
that
interesting.
Again, playing the role of the objects creating the role.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other piece that I've always thought about with these images is the audience of the supporters of the institutions that are being shown in these pictures. And, you know, so many of the Carlisle Indian photographs are about the Apaches coming in their outfits, and then here they are 3 months later, and the civilization that's been taken that they show by wearing the military uniforms, and thus the efficacy of the Carlisle school. So here, give us more money. You know, here's the object lesson of the fact that we're creating civilization.
Right, exactly. Look, it works.
Right.
What we're doing is correct.
Right.
And I think it's that transformation that in part made this so fascinating to me, because here he is, a
right.
Native student.
He's gone back. Right?
He's gone back, but perhaps showing.
Way, right?
Exactly, but to feel, maybe perhaps as you suggest, to feel again what it would be like
right.
to wear those clothes.
If he wasn't now civilized. Right.
Right.
I have to say, if he's a Native student, he knows full well that outfit is wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
right.
We people who are other, we're the first ones to know when we're putting on a show.
Right.
And we know why. We are very clear on all of that.
Exactly.
So I think there's a whole lot more going on.
I think so, too.
In that issue. Whole lot.
Is he currently a student when he does this, or is
yes.
he coming? Someone said like came back.
He's been here for 2 years at this
okay.
point, which is how I know that that's not his hair. I mean, that's one of the first things that Hampton would make them cut their hair immediately.
Mm-hmm.
They want everyone to conform to the gender standards that they want for their students. So he's been there for 2 years. He's just spent the previous summer, and this is again November 30th. So right around this time of year, he had spent the summer before in Massachusetts working on a farm. He actually later goes on to serve in World War I afterwards as a middle-aged man. But he's been there for a couple years at this point, and he's there for I think one more year before he goes back to Crow Creek and marries marries Minnie. Exactly.
Well, maybe we'll bring out the sushi and turn this into a slightly more informal conversation.
Thank
Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.